Welcome to the Mo Money, Mo Progress podcast. We bring you interviews with amazing people who share advice about how to make more money and manage what you got.
Hello, welcome back to Mo Money, Mo Progress. My name is Gwen, and I am psyched that you decided to listen to this podcast today. My negotiation hero is on the show today. Not just my negotiation hero. I discovered Susan Sue on an interview on YouTube with Ramit Sethi, originally of IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com. And the interview that Ramit did with Susan has been seen over, I think, 125,000 times at this point. And when I was first starting out and I had a job opportunity and I had literally zero clue how to negotiate anything, I watched this interview probably 10 times. And since then, I've been down the Susan Sue rabbit hole. I signed up for her newsletter on her website and am absolutely inspired and fascinated by her. And I'm so excited about this interview today. And Susan right now, she is a startup marketer and a writer and a yogi. And she has worked for a ton of incredible startups, including AppSumo. She's currently working on the distribution team at 500 Startups. She's actually worked with Ramit Sethi at I Will Teach You to Be Rich. She's worked at Google. I mean, she went to Stanford. She's the kind of gal you want to get tips from. And during this interview, she's actually in Bali. Oh yes, she's in Bali. I was in Beaverton, my hometown. From Toronto. But this was actually a really interesting interview because you can actually hear like dogs in the background and really get a sense of where the ambiance of where she is. So it's actually really fun and had no desire to edit that out. Try to keep it real here at Mo Money, Mo Progress. So grab your coffee, grab your notepad, take some notes. It's time to raise your salary and raise your freelance fees. Ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with Susan Sue.
Okay, so Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Gwen. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I am simply thrilled. And I know we were just talking that you're in a very interesting place right now. So before we get to the rapid fire, can you just tell everybody, where are you right now?
I am specifically in a co-working space called Ubud in Ubud, Bali, Indonesia. So Bali is an island. It's kind of like a state in Indonesia. Ubud is a city, or maybe like halfway between a town and a city on the island of Bali. And I am in a co-working space that's kind of meant for freelancers and entrepreneurs and location independent people, because the Wi-Fi here is really good. It's much better than in the beautiful house where I live, which happens to be in the middle of a rice field and a jungle, and therefore not really good internet connectivity.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm trying to picture where you are right now. Very inspiring. You make me want to go there. All right. So let's get into this. So Susan, my first rapid fire question for you is, what is your greatest extravagance?
Well, I guess that inspires another question back to you from me. What do you mean by extravagance?
Great question. Well, to me, an extravagance is something that you buy that you don't really need, but it's one of those things where you buy it because it just makes your life better. Like for me, I would say Uber. Like I don't need Uber. I could easily walk or take public transportation, but it's just so great. And it costs a little extra money, so that's mine. So what would you say yours is?
You know, I actually pay for a lot. Well, if that's how you define extravagance, I would say my life is pretty much filled with extravagances. My guiding philosophy, it's taken me some time to get here. I'm now 31 years old, so I'm quite a bit past college and, you know, past my college kind of living days. I would say that my greatest extravagance is to extend generosity to myself in every way that I can, because I believe that that is important. It's a precursor to being able to be generous and abundant to other people. So the way that translates in a material sense is all kinds of ways. So like if I am having a hard day and I need to pay a little bit more for a ride home, like Uber or whatever it is, a taxi ride here in Ubud, I'm happy, doesn't matter. I really like to tip people. So if somebody helps me out, whether that's in a cafe or a restaurant or a driver or just somebody that seems to be in need, I never hold back on that. I don't withhold, because for me, you know, there's always more where that came from. And for the other person, it means so much. So those might be considered extravagances in other people's books. To me, it's kind of like an everyday thing. And it's a really important part of the way that I live my daily life. And then I actually spend a lot of, I guess, unnecessary money on my personal well-being and my health. So I buy really nice food for myself. I feel that, you know, actually, it's funny. I was just talking to my 86-year-old grandpa because we just had Chinese New Year. So I gave him a call for Chinese New Year. And he said, Susan, I'm really happy that you're having a, you have a good job and blah, 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 all this stuff. But you know, the most important thing is your health. If you don't, and it's just like a total talking at kind of guy. He used to be the editor of a big newspaper in China. So he's really used to having people listen to him. And so he went on and on at me about how your health is really the only thing that you have. And so if you don't take care of that, you know, your job or your finances or saving money on this and that, doesn't really matter. So I never, ever hold back when it comes to my personal health and well-being.
I got to know, what's one of your grandfather's advice or pieces of advice on how to stay healthy?
He has, believe it or not, he has a lot of specific advice that he has repeated to me many, many times over the years. One of them is not to get up too early. I get up quite early because I practice yoga every day, and he thinks that I get up too early. So he feels that he needs to constantly remind me not to get up too early, and that a person my age and younger needs at least 8 hours of sleep. He likes to say that. And his other big thing, very simple to implement, is first thing in the morning, the first thing you do when you wake up, you must drink one big glass of water before you do anything else.
Is he a fan of the lemon water that's popular in North America?
I think he's not quite trendy enough to be doing lemon water. A little bit still old communist style, just plain cheap water. But yeah, I think it's, you know, really come down through the generations. He's passed down through an entire family a strong sense of kind of respect for health and self-preservation in the kind of physical and spiritual well-being sense. That's really important not to be too stressed out. It's kind of funny, like on the one hand, he wants us all to work really hard, especially the younger generation. But on the other hand, if he thinks we're working too hard, he does not hesitate to tell us so.
Well, I mean, it's good to have that North Star of health. So I love hearing that. What is the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word money?
It's something I like. It's value, and it's simply a symbol. It's just a symbol of the value of things in the world. It's a symbol of how safe I feel in the world. So when I hear the word money, I mostly think of all of these symbolic and metaphoric meanings behind money. It's not just the dollars in my wallet.
And what is your favorite financial tool or app that you might use?
You know, I use Mint.com. I do like it. It's pretty good. But I also, one of my favorite tools or apps, I guess you could call it, is just a basic Google spreadsheet. I really like to spreadsheet a lot of different aspects of my life, whether that's a budget. Most favorite thing I like to do is what I call a post budget. So I like to go back over an experience in my life or a trip or a project and kind of analyze without judgment, just objective observation, analyze how much did I spend in what area. And I feel you can definitely do this through Mint.com. Especially with categories, but sometimes I just like having my own fully granular control over what my, I just feel a spreadsheet is simpler for controlling how you label stuff. And so I really like to use Google spreadsheets for that.
I am honestly right there with you. What was your first freelance job ever?
Freelance job. I probably did a few freelance jobs in college that were non-memorable, but I would say the first freelance job that really kind of helped me to get into the kind of work that I do now, so therefore the more important first freelance job ever, was one year I had, it was 2008. So in the United States, there was kind of like an economic downturn, and the startup that I was working for, although they had just received $30 million in funding the previous year, they had basically burned through about 90% of that within 1 year, and they started laying people off. And I actually survived 3 rounds of layoffs, but by the beginning of 2009, I was also let go. I was on the product team at that company, and everybody was laid off except for the boss of that team, which is kind of ironic because then he's the boss of no one after that. But the first freelance job I had was actually born from that experience. I was sort of in this floating period. I didn't have that much to do, and a friend of mine, actually Ramit Sethi, connected me with another startup that needed somebody to write an ebook about neuroplasticity, which is your brain's ability to kind of be flexible and to change over time through inputs that you give it. And actually, it's kind of like a beautiful metaphor now too, because at that time, I didn't think that, even though I was so young, I didn't know I could change my career. I didn't know I could change my focus. I didn't know anything about brain science or neuroplasticity or anything like that. But I just figured it out as I went along. I wrote this ebook. It was only a few thousand dollars that it brought in for me, but it was a huge help. It was a boost to my confidence, and it showed me, wow, I can actually do freelancing. Anybody can do freelancing. You just kind of need one start. And then from there, it's really easy to kind of roll it into the next step and the next step and the next step. And that is essentially plasticity. That's the definition of plasticity, is that kind of flexibility. So it's kind of funny how that worked out.
I always think that sometimes in a career, when you do some random things that doesn't make sense, one day it'll all make sense. I just think that's really interesting though. And we'll get more into your freelance, how you figured out the freelance negotiation in a little bit. What is something that you patiently saved up for to buy?
You know what? I have to say that I'm not a huge saver. So maybe I'm not the best person to answer this question. For me, it's more important to make money. So to make enough money to buy something, I kind of don't really, stuff that I can't afford right now usually doesn't enter my desire field. So I'm not much of a saving up to buy kind of person, just because if I can't afford it right now, then I kind of don't even let myself know about it. And yeah, I think maybe from very little, I've never been great at saving money. So I've always just opted to double down on earning the money that I need.
Well, you are the absolute perfect person to be talking to on this podcast, because I mean, I think the advice of save, especially when, you know, you're a young person starting out, you're not making a lot of money. So saving is extremely hard. So earning more is really important.
Exactly.
So tell us about your favorite financial book or resource that really helped you on your path.
I would have to say, just knowing Ramit was really helpful for me from a financial perspective. I mean, I didn't really think about it too much before. I love his book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. I think it's only like 10 or 12 bucks. I mean, it's so fun to read, and it's just easy to access. Aside from that, I've gotten a lot of sort of my financial attitude from my family and our kind of familial culture around resource management and money. So my family are very frugal, and yet they're also, because they're Chinese, they're also very generous. And it's because in Chinese culture, if you're not all Chinese families follow this, by the way, but mine certainly does. If you're not generous, it's actually seen as a loss of face. It's actually kind of embarrassing. So generosity has like more of a self, kind of like a self-serving aspect to it too, which is, it's signaling sort of your family's strength and their ability to be generous. So while we have always emphasized don't spend what you don't have, and, you know, really try to spend on things that are only necessary and all that, still when it comes to helping other people or helping your own self in a time of need, that's when it's time to be generous. So it's frugality and generosity together.
That's pretty much perfect. And I love, you know, just hearing the message of how valued generosity is, because I feel like sometimes we live in a very, like, a scarcity culture where it's like, oh, I can't give that little bit extra because I need it for me. But it's amazing when you give, like, what will come out of that for you and for the other person. And my final rapid fire question is, if you were given $10,000 today, no strings attached, what would you do with it?
Wonderful thing to think about. When I'm feeling bored or mind numbed, I will just think about this rapid fire question, like, let my mind go off into dreamland. I think it kind of depends on one thing. So it depends on what stage I'm at in my life and whether I'm looking to go in a new direction or kind of hold steady in my current direction. That would be the fork in the road question. If I'm looking to go in a new direction, I would definitely, and I think kind of, this probably, if I had to answer it with one answer only, I would say this, the following. I would definitely take that $10,000 and invest it in myself. I've heard this from a lot of entrepreneurs, and I believe it wholeheartedly myself. if you don't have the confidence to invest in yourself, then what business do you have in investing in other people? Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, angel investing has become kind of like this sexy thing mm-hmm. for amongst people who have a little bit of extra money. But, you know, the response to that, and there's nothing wrong with angel investing. It's a great way to diversify your portfolio and get involved in startups and get involved in investing, blah, blah, blah. But I'm just talking about for the regular person, right? If you don't believe in yourself enough to first and foremost always invest in yourself, then I think that's kind of the precursor issue. So that is more important than anything else. Now, if I, and when I say invest in yourself, I would mean, okay, like let's say there's a course or a self-improvement program or a development program or a skill development program that you've really been looking at and you've decided, okay, I really want to learn Chinese or I really want to learn web development because I can see it helping me in my trajectory in this way. Then I would, without hesitation, put the money towards that before anything else. If there isn't anything that stands out really clearly like that at whatever point in time in my life that I get that $10,000 today, let's say, then I would just invest it into, I would just put it straight into my investment funds and just let it kind of diversify. I use mutual funds and all of this and I just kind of let it diversify through that. But I think most important is investing it in yourself, because $10,000 invested into yourself compounded over the lifetime of you can be huge. Mm-hmm. It will yield greater than 8% returns. It's better than putting it into a mutual fund.
Yeah. Oh my God. I really feel like your message of investing in yourself is coming across so clearly, and I find it to be so powerful, because I feel like we're all trying to find answers and outside of ourselves, and you keep bringing it back to, you know, put the money, put the time into yourself, and then amazing things will happen. And we're just getting started, really. So mm-hmm. now I'd love to ask you, so you went to Stanford. I imagine going to Stanford, there might be, you know, some pressure from people to say like, oh, what will Susan do after that? So I'd love to hear about your experience with getting your first job out of school and how you navigated the negotiation process for that first job.
This is a great story about money, Gwen. And I will tell you the reason why is because when I graduated from Stanford, I was a humanities major. I majored in history, and I didn't have like a lot of human and social capital to teach me, okay, this is what you do in the real world. This is how you network and this is how you get a job. I didn't do fancy internships. No, instead, in my summers at Stanford, I got weird grants and I went abroad and I studied in different countries. And I basically didn't do all the things that like my iBanking classmates were all busy doing. I didn't have internships, things like that. So when it came time to apply for a job after I graduated, I sent out over 100 resumes and I didn't hear back a single response. Not one single response.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. So that summer I had like some babysitting job over the summer and I was like, what am I going to do? All I knew, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself, but all I knew was, okay, I spoke 4 languages. I was really interested in kind of international affairs, and not like from a diplomacy or political or economic standpoint, but just other cultures, other people, other places, and travel. And I loved languages. I'm really, really good at them. Just, it's like one of my hard to monetize aptitudes that brings me so much joy in life. So I knew whatever job I get has to have something to do with that. I was going back to Seattle, my hometown. Couldn't find anything. It's an even tougher job market in Seattle, certainly, than it is in the Bay Area for young people. But I did end up finding, through Craigslist, I ended up finding a position through AmeriCorps, which is basically unpaid, barely stipended, essentially unpaid national service at a day worker center. A day worker center is a place where largely undocumented immigrants, largely from Central America, some other parts of Latin America, come to find work for the day, like hourly work, doing whatever contract labor, etc., just for the day. And it was to teach English and do wage claims, which is to help people get unpaid wages that their bosses promised them and then didn't end up paying for them. And it was going to be 100% in Spanish, a language which I had just learned in college. So I thought, okay, I think I can do this. Why not? So I signed up to do that, and my pay was, it was actually taxed, which is so insane, because when I tell you how much it is, you're going to cry. After tax, I was making $800 a month, working 40 hours, you know, or over 40 hours a week.
That's nuts. Imagine where you are today, looking back on that, you're like, oh my God, you want to give your little self a hug. Like, you'll get through this.
just amazing. And you know, I lived at home. I lived at my parents' house, but I actually paid my mom rent.
It's amazing.
So I paid her, like, I think my rent was $250 a month.
Man.
I know. And I got a, I did have a food stamps card. So I used that for a lot of my food.
Wow.
And I just, you know, cooked at home. I didn't like buy a lot of stuff. I didn't buy new clothes. I even managed to save money that year. I think I saved like $150 a month, every month. So that was my, I couldn't negotiate for that because there's no, I mean, obviously there's no room for negotiation. It's just a stipend, the same stipend that everybody else gets. However, I will say something really special about that year, besides just the fact that I you know, practiced my Spanish. I helped so many people. I think I helped people negotiate over $20,000 language, helped them to renegotiate over $20,000 in back wages, which I was so, was really, really proud of. And this is like people that obviously needed the money more than my 22-year-old self living at home did, you know, people that couldn't qualify for food stamps and things like that. So it really taught me a lesson in humility and just kind of appreciating what I have. But I managed to actually, you know, as I mentioned, I managed to save money that year. But the great thing about AmeriCorps that was really helpful to me at that time, I came out of Stanford with a small sum in student loans. I think it was like $20,000. I mean, Stanford has great aid packages. So $20,000 in student loans to go to Stanford is actually tiny.
I was going to say, that sounds pretty good from my understanding of Stanford. So
yeah. And I think AmeriCorps, that, so after I completed the year, they actually give you a student loan award. It was like $5,500 or maybe $6,000, something in that ballpark. And I felt that that was really wonderful because it was an amount of money that I could kind of use to pay down my stress, or, you know, pay down my my debt, my financial worry about debt, that I couldn't use on anything else. It was never going to go into Nordstrom's or, yes. You know, there's no risk there because you can only pay it towards your student loans. So, you know, the year of making $800 a month and still paying rent and all that stuff, it was such great practice on living within whatever means I had and still finding space. You know, I didn't feel cramped. So I think for all the listeners out there who are young college grads and thinking about, well, how will I ever have the money for X? It's really just about finding space, right? Money just represents freedom. It's not anything else than that. And what is freedom in our lives but space? Space to be ourselves, space to do what we want, space to kind of stretch our arms out and move in the way that we want to move in the direction that we want to move. So if you can find that within $800 a month or within $2,000 a month or whatever amount that you have, then you are free. It doesn't matter if you have four figures more, because that doesn't necessarily accord you more freedom. Sure, it might, but what I'm saying is it is possible to find that amount of freedom within whatever constraints you have, for most of us, for the most part. Sure, some people are really hard up, but I don't think anybody listening to a podcast is in that boat.
That's such an amazing point that you bring up as well about living within your means, because I know even personally, when I was first starting out and then being able to double my income at one point, it was like, I still felt I wasn't actually able to live within my means. In my mind, it was like, oh, I'm making this much more money. I can live in a bigger way. And then it's like, why is life still a little bit hard? So being able to balance at like $800 a month could, I would hope, you know, would really set your foundation of like, I really need to look at this when you start making more money. So what would you say is your job that you had when you're like, wow, I'm making a salary now? Like, what was that job and how did you figure out how to get paid for that job?
I went straight from that AmeriCorps experience making $800 a month into working at Google at like one of their entry level salary slots. At Google, it's very hard to negotiate. They have like a really, I mean, if you're in sales, perhaps if you're an all-star engineer and you've already got a personal brand and, you know, you're really specialized or whatever, then, you know, you have more wiggle room. But for me, where I was at, there was almost none. I had research and I had heard from my friends that it was up to like a 1 to 2%. This is at that time in 2006. It might be different now. So like a 1 to 2% wiggle room. But actually, I didn't even take advantage of that because I didn't know you could negotiate. So I applied for that job. I was offered it and I just took what I got, you know, mm-hmm. took what they offered me basically. And it was just like you said, Gwen, it was funny because I still felt like it was harder than to live within my means than it was when I was making $800 a month, partly because I was surrounded by so many more things going on in the Bay Area. I was, you know, not really just with my family anymore, but more like around friends and peers and a lot of peers at Google and people like driving really nice cars. God knows how. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand how on $50,000 a year you can afford a $50,000 luxury car. I guess with the payment plan, but it affects your mind, you know, when you see that every day rolling into the parking lot. I knew I didn't want that for myself, but it still affects, you know, your sense of abundance. So that was really challenging. And actually my first job where I felt like, whoa, I have money now.
Let's talk about that job. I'm liking this already.
I actually had been working at Google for a couple of years and I got a call from a recruiter found my information on LinkedIn and said, hey, we are recruiting I'm from High Five for a startup in San Francisco. And I like the sound of that because at that time I was living in Palo Alto, which is in Silicon Valley on the peninsula. It's about 35 miles south of San Francisco. And I had really been wanting to, it's the town that Stanford is in/next to. And the whole time I'd been really wanting to move to San Francisco, but I couldn't figure out how to do it financially and with the commute to Google and all that stuff.
The rent in the Bay Area. Man.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And the rent. Yeah, exactly. So this recruiter said, hey, I'd like to, you know, talk to you about this position we have open. And that job, you know, all things went well. They wanted to offer me the position. It came time to negotiate. I had been reading a book at that time. I can't remember how I initially found it, but I had been reading a book called Ask For It, which is sort of about women and negotiations. A bright pink book caught my attention at the bookstore, at the physical bookstore I still shopped at. And I read it cover to cover and I was like, oh my God, this is some sort of dawning realization moment. All of these things I didn't know and like all of my male colleagues, blah, blah, blah. So I decided to negotiate that job. But of course, I was really inexperienced. So I didn't know how to actually do it. And I didn't understand at that time that negotiation isn't about fighting and it isn't about getting. It isn't about getting what you want or arguing anything like that. Negotiation is actually just about finding agreement with people. Mm-hmm. You can negotiate anything, whether it's your salary with a potential employer or who's going to do the dishes tonight with your partner or your spouse. It's actually just about finding accord and harmony. So I didn't understand that at that time. I just thought it was about getting something, about getting more, specifically about getting more. So I went back to the recruiter and I asked for some huge amount that it wasn't benchmarked in anything, right? I was just like, this. And I'll never forget their response. It was four grown men on the other end of a conference call. And I was like 25 and just had blurted out some like huge six figures. It's like so ridiculous. It was over twice my current salary.
That's some courage right there. I like that. I want to know where that came from, but I got to hear this story too.
Well, courage and stupidity, because it wasn't very researched. And I'll never forget what they said. They said, long pause. Susan, okay, we're just going to, we'll get back to you. Bye. Click. Oh. Yeah, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did this. I suddenly knew that I had completely missed the point. Now, there's one thing when women or young people don't ask for it, don't ask for what they want or what they need or their fair salary or whatever. There's another thing called overcompensation or overshooting when mm-hmm. you ask way too much and it's completely unfounded and unresearched. So that is, I went from one extreme to the complete opposite extreme, which was not so good for me at that time. Luckily, that is when I reached out to Ramit. I found out about Ramit from reading an article in the New York Times that was about his blog and kind of some of the work that he had been doing. He hadn't even published his book yet at that time. And I mentioned something learning about negotiation. And I didn't know him at Stanford, but we did both go to Stanford. We're only a year apart. We went to Stanford at the same time. Email saying, hey, from a fellow classmate, I didn't know you at that time, but here's my dilemma. I would love to get your input on this. And he put up some barriers. He said, okay, meet me at this weird office park, middle of the peninsula. Like, it was not a nice office park. It's not really in Palo Alto or San Francisco. It was in like Redwood Shores or some weird place like that. And I didn't even have a car. So how was I going to get there? I had to borrow somebody's car, you know, drive there on using my non-smartphone, didn't have a smartphone at that time, and met with him in this really sketchy diner where there was not a single thing on the menu I wanted to eat or drink.
This is so weird, but I love it.
And he spent, I can't remember how long now, but I know it was more than 1 hour and less than 3 hours of his afternoon coaching me in negotiations with only one catch, which was that I had to agree to be recorded for future negotiation stuff that he wanted to do later. I don't think he ever ended up using that material, but he wanted to put up these barriers to make sure I was really serious and that I was willing to kind of pony up some of my own stuff, my own efforts to work with him. And anyway, he taught me all these great things. It helped me a ton. I went back to the recruiter. I was able to salvage that whole situation. And I ended up getting my first job that paid me a wow sum of money. And at that time, I think it was like $88,000 a year or something. And for me, like at age 25, having just 2.5 years prior been working for $800 a month, it was a huge deal. I felt, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. It's amazing. What kind of life have I stepped into? And I think it was actually really a positive experience for me just in learning that good things can happen and that abundance can happen, because it kind of opened my mind and it opened my heart to all the future things that have come since then. Since then, I have never had to worry about money, and I have always just trusted that more good things will keep coming. And I think that it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, actually. So if you trust that that happens, you get one positive leading indicator, and then you just keep trusting and keep trusting, and then it just comes. And I don't think it's like a secret invite your destiny kind of thing. I think it's more just like the more you believe something, the more you consciously and subconsciously organize your behavior and therefore your reality towards that something, and the more you make it come true for you.
I also got to say the fact that you were willing to, I just feel like you're just reminding me that everything happens for a reason, because if you hadn't put that, you know, six-figure sum out there and made that mistake, you wouldn't have contacted Ramit. You're on YouTube on that video. It's been seen 120,000 times about how to negotiate. That's how I discovered you. You know, like, it's just, if you weren't willing to put yourself out there and just ask for it. I mean, and who knows who will hear this conversation and will help them to negotiate and think a little bit bigger. So it's blowing my mind right now, Susan, if I'm going to be honest with you.
So those are the kinds of things where I think if you open yourself to those possibilities and you trust that things are going to turn out well because you're earnest and kind of coming at it with a good heart, then I think a lot of amazing things can happen. But you can't trust conditionally. You can't be like, okay, destiny, or okay, world, I'll trust you if you give me something first. So this is how a lot of us go through life. We're very conditional with our faith. Mm-hmm. We're very conditional with our generosity. We're very conditional with our love. We'll give it if we can promise that we'll get something back. I used to say, little kids say this to each other all the time. I remember saying this to other little kids. Okay, I have a question I want to ask you. But first, you have to promise you're going to say yes.
Yep.
So we actually care adulthood, and we apply it to so many things all throughout our life. I will open myself up to you, but first you have to promise it's going to go my way before I do that. So actually, when we ask this, when we take this attitude, we're closing ourselves off to how big goodness can really be. And so I think it's really important to just totally let yourself be open to what can happen. And even if something doesn't turn out well, like what happened with the first conversation, me asking for six-figure salary, actually, You have to trust that that is just a temporary stepping stone into things turning out even better than you could have imagined because you didn't have the vocabulary to imagine it before.
Right. And man, I have a couple more questions to ask you. And you're bringing up the something I wanted to touch on, which is so you moved on from High Five. You've worked at a ton of other startups. You're working at one now. I imagine that it wasn't easy for you to walk away from working at that very popular startup in Austin to take a break and a sabbatical. Can you tell us about that experience of walking away? I believe it was AppSumo for 10 months.
AppSumo is a great company. They make money. It's a cash positive business. Noah's one of the smartest marketers and business people on the planet. Absolutely. It's a really good team, but it just wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. And Austin just wasn't for me. It's kind of like, you know, if you had a tuning fork and you could tune yourself. If you yourself were a tuning fork and you could tune yourself to different places in the world and feel whether there's like a kind of vibrational connection between you and that place, it's like I was doing that with Austin and I just was getting all this noise back. I just didn't feel like the green lights were there for me. And I actually tried very in earnest for, I think it was a little bit over 6 months. And I kept getting all these signals. Okay, this is not right. This is not right. And also I was waking up in the middle of the night with like just feeling anxious already, or my heart was beating fast. There's all these kind of like signals that I could hear my grandpa's voice in the back of my head. You are not taking care of the most important thing that you're here to take care of, which is your health and your ability to continue to be abundant and happy and prosperous in your life. And I just thought, you know what? If I walk away from this, everything will be fine. And it all comes back to that same trust question again. You have to trust yourself and you have to trust that everything that you've done and the strengths and capacity you have spent the earlier periods of your life building, if you really trust yourself, then you must trust that those things were right and that at this kind of juncture or question point in your life, you'll know your intuition will tell you what to do. And I guess a short way of putting that is we second guess ourselves all the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's good to be analytical. It's good to be skeptical. Okay. We don't want to be overly faith-based and just take everything at face value. We don't want to do that. But if you trust yourself, like deeply trust yourself in your quietest moments, when you're not talking to somebody else and you're not on the internet, you're not even talking to yourself and maybe your eyes aren't even open. When you're really in that moment, I think we always know what's the right answer. So actually, once you know what the right answer is, it's really hard not to follow it. It's actually very easy to go in the direction that's you're meant clear to go once it's clear. Mm-hmm. So it was like that situation for me with AppSumo. Like on the surface, everything was really great and it was a really great company. Noah and I were such close friends, and it's like what a gift to be able to work with somebody that's your close friend and almost like a family member, you know? But a lot of the other things weren't right, and the signals that my body was sending me was telling me, okay, all these things aren't right. And I just thought, if this, no time like the present, right? If this doesn't work out, then at least I know I can still go back to my life as it is right now. But if it does, then who knows? Maybe, and this comes back to that question of the vocabulary you don't have right now, maybe I will open up onto a vista, onto a reality that I cannot even picture because I've never seen such a thing before.
And one thing you mentioned in a blog post that blew my mind, because I feel like a lot of myself, as well as many people that are listening to a podcast on the topic of money and life, would resonate with this. It's, you mentioned that doing less might be the hardest thing that you've ever done. And I'd love to hear how taking that time and doing less helped you kind of recalibrate and get to where you are today.
Yeah, it was really, really important. I mean, it's still very hard for me. My personality type is, you know, more of a go personality. I talk fast. I say a lot of things in a small span of time. I am not naturally relaxed. And that's why, you know, startups like people like me and companies like people like me, because we get a lot of stuff done. But is that the best thing for the self? Is that the best thing for whatever thing lives inside this body that's sitting here talking to you right now? I'm not sure. In fact, I don't think it is the best thing. And so kind of realizing that, you know, that whole experience with when I was at AppSumo, it's not necessarily directly related to AppSumo, but my experience at that time really showed me that, you know, our bodies are such an important indicator, a signal of where we really are at. And my body wasn't doing very well. I didn't feel good.
I had a lot of like kind of stress and anxiety related issues. And so I decided to kind of take this time for myself. And when you go, you know, the way that I had structured my trip, I went to India, I went to go see a teacher I had heard about that was my teacher's teacher. And there's really not a lot to do. And I met a lot of other people who had come from a completely different background from me. There are, believe it or not, there are a lot of people in the world that are not type A.
I don't know them.
You know what?
Yes.
Exactly. I didn't know any of them. I didn't know anybody that wasn't like me. And so it was so valuable. In fact, maybe one of the most valuable things I'd ever done in my life to go and be surrounded by a bunch of people that were completely not like me. They kind of looked like me. They maybe were from other Western countries. They had at least enough money to buy a plane ticket and go somewhere, you know, in the middle of Asia. But aside from that, they were, you know, maybe we had some of the same habits. We all knew about yoga. But aside from that, we had really essentially nothing in common. Deep down, they were so unlike me. And I didn't feel that I had to compare myself to them, but it was almost like being around completely foreign culture and alien culture, just observing. I was so curious. Wow, how can these people just be so okay with themselves doing nothing? They just go and like do some yoga in the morning and they just like hang out all day. My God, how is that possible? You know, I was at that time 28. I had spent the past 27 years of my life being like all wound up. And so it was, yeah, extremely, extremely valuable for me just to kind of observe a different mode of existence and also to observe the results of that mode of existence, which were actually not that unlike my own results.
Whoa.
So that was a key takeaway. I mean, I spent a lot of time kind of getting back in touch with my health and then doing a lot of like manual things. Like when you live in India, there are a lot of inconveniences, especially where we were living, where I was living in Goa. You know, you don't have like the first year didn't have like a washing machine and there's nobody to clean your house. Like sure, everybody thinks you can get a person to come and help you clean your house in India, but the reality is they don't show up, or they may say they show up, but then something comes up in their lives. They can't get transportation there, or they're child gets sick. And it's not like in the West where you can just order a cleaning service online and it's like if they don't come, then you can write them a bad review on Yelp or something. You know, it's just unimaginable to most of us. But a lot of sort of our basic, my own basic caretaking needs were once again left up to me. I couldn't outsource or downsource anything anymore. And so a lot of my day just ended up being kind of filled with that stuff. And it was really helpful for me because it's very humbling and it just puts all of the other stuff, the more abstract, you put a lot of the abstract stuff into perspective. And it helped me to return to that world with a much more peaceful demeanor.
And to everyone who's listening, you have to read Susan's, your blog post, like go back a little bit, you know, on the archive at susansue.com, because I remember reading that. I you know, I'm always like kind of curious about what you're up to because you're just, your lifestyle is always stuck in my mind. So yeah, I just remember reading those blog posts and they're so honest and vulnerable and open. I'm like, yes, I love this lady's energy. Yeah. So I highly recommend that. I have two more questions for you, Susan. So
for sure,
if you could give listeners one piece of advice, not even necessarily money advice, I feel like this has been a real life conversation as well. Like what one piece of advice would you want to give to people? Just life advice. What would you say?
I will cheat and squeeze two things into one.
I'll allow it this one time.
All right. So the first thing I think is trust yourself. There's nobody else that knows anything more. You can learn a little bit of tactics and, you know, some skills here and there, external stuff. But for the things that really matter, if you have your inner compass properly calibrated, then nothing will ever harm you. Nothing will go wrong. You have to trust yourself. And in order to trust yourself, you have to reestablish a relationship with yourself. This is what I had lost over many years of looking outside of myself for validation and for, you know, kind of resources in the form of money or recognition or whatever else. I had lost a sense of that relationship with myself. And quitting my job at AppSumo and, you know, going and doing this crazy thing, a lot of that was about kind of reestablishing and kind of teasing out or slowly trying to get back in touch with that inner self that had gone so deep into hiding because she had been hurt and ignored a lot of times. And so you have to trust yourself, but before you can trust yourself, you have to show that you're worthy of your own trust by establishing that relationship in a nurturing and loving way. That is the most important thing, I think, in life, is finding that peace and trust and faith within yourself. The second thing that's related to that, when you trust inside yourself and you trust that even if things are temporarily not going well, and again, keyword temporarily, everything is temporary. So whether it's good or bad, not right now is only temporary. If things are temporarily going poorly, or temporarily, maybe temporarily going well, but let's say they're temporarily going poorly, you have to trust that change will come, because it will. Like, it'll come whether you trust it does or not. So change will come. And because things will always be changing, there's no need ever to be stingy or cheap with first yourself and second, the other people around you. So trust yourself and be generous and all will be well.
I feel like I should take that quote and put it on a poster and put it on my wall. I might be doing that. And I'm sure, I mean, honestly, we've only really scratched the surface of your story. And I'd love to ask you, okay, kind of a two-part final question is, how can people support you and connect with you? And what's like one thing that you want to do or make happen for yourself in the near future that we can support you on?
So I have an email newsletter. So to the extent that people can encourage me to keep going with that, because I think it's a really healthy thing for me and I get really positive feedback from it. So to the extent you can help me to get on that, that will be really a wonderful gift back to me. You can sign up for the newsletter at my website, just susansue.com. And then when you like move around a little bit, I think you get like a pop-up or something. And I think I also have a page at susansue.com/newsletter. So that would probably be the main thing. And then in terms of the stuff that I care about, if I could ask everybody that's listening for anything, I would just say, be generous with yourself and be generous with other people and the world will be a better place. But you know what? You can't give to other people. You can't be generous with other people or the world or animals or plants or places or anything that you care about unless it starts with you first. Too many of us are really unkind and quite stingy with ourselves. So that is really important. If you take nothing else away from this conversation, dear listener, be generous to yourself and all else will follow.
Again, signing off with some wise words. Susan, thank you so much for your time. I'll be sure to link up everything you talked about on the show and the notes below, and just really appreciate your time today. This has been such a rich conversation.
Thank you so much, Gwen. It was really nice talking to you.
Thank you for listening. To find more interviews and tips to help you make Mo money, go to momoneymoprogress.com.